There's an old joke that says that the ministry wouldn't be so bad if it wasn't for people. Working with people has its great blessings and it has its great frustrations, and especially in the funeral planning process, you see both sides of that. You see wonderful blessings, but you can also run into those frustrating sides. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about how to avoid conflict with families during the funeral planning process. I think it's important to understand that quite often, because of our sinful nature, we're not very logical in the first place. But you throw grief into the mix and we're going to be more illogical than ever. It's important for us pastors to remember when we're working with families that we can't expect them to think clearly. Not in the middle of grief. That's just not, it's not a reasonable expectation. And quite often when something goes awry in funeral planning, I'll hear a pastor complain about the family and whatever, and behind those complaints sometimes is that assumption that somehow that family needs, should be able to think clearly. Well, in the midst of their grief, they may not be able to be. I think that establishes a certain point for us to remember that I think helps us accept what's happening better as pastors and helps us control the outcome to a gospel solution better too. It helps us to remember that there's really not enough time a lot of times between the death of a person and their funeral to catechize a family on what a proper funeral is, what are the correct do's and don'ts, why we don't like eulogies, why that poem can't be used, why that song can't be used. There's really not a lot of time to do that. And because we sometimes fly by the seat of our pants and let these things happen without proper thought beforehand, we get into trouble in these matters. I think it's important as a pastor to remember that because the funeral often is happening in the building in which your church receives Christ's body and blood for the forgiveness of their sins, where the means of grace are offered, that all services need to be held under sort of that umbrella, the umbrella of the gospel presented to us in the means of grace. So rather than concentrating on emergency catechization of a family over 3 or 4 days on what's right and wrong in funerals, take the time under less stressful situations under a less stressful environment to catechize the whole congregation on it. Maybe you begin with your board of elders and you start talking about, well, what have we done as a congregation with regard to funerals? What has been allowed, not allowed in the past? And then start to catechize them, maybe use an adult Bible study, then catechize the congregation as a whole toward the idea of maybe writing a policy. I remember I had the idea of writing a funeral and a wedding policy in my first parish many years ago. I never got around to doing it because I took a call too fast. But in my second parish, we did write policies for weddings and funerals. The thing about policies, they are law, yes, I admit that. But they also save face, especially with regard to those very difficult decisions or those times when you may have to tell either a bridal couple or a grieving family, no, we can't do that. It would compromise the gospel. What we often did was we would write the policies and we would then present, we would teach the policies and then we would present them to the voters' assembly and ratify them as a congregation. This gives you one extra little talking point in all of this. You should, when you're dealing with any request regarding a funeral or a wedding for that matter, you should explain the theological reasons why it's not a good idea to do those things. But with the policy in hand, you have the one extra little thing that seems to always negate the anger that could potentially arise, and that is, it's the will of, I'll use my congregation, it's the will of St. John's congregation that we don't do that. And that's stated in our policy. And you can then produce a copy of the policy as well. I'm an advocate of policies with regard to weddings and funerals. I believe that they have really saved me and the congregation, I think, a lot of grief. And in the end, there hasn't been any, I think, negative ramifications from the times I've had to use the policy in that way. Generally speaking, families kind of back down once they realize that they're having the funeral in a certain place, and that certain place has theologically based stipulations for what they do. That leads me to a discussion of what about after the funeral? You've developed a bit of a relationship with the loved ones of the dying of the either dying person or the person who has died, I do recommend getting to those people. They may require counseling afterwards. That has to be assessed depending on, for instance, the nature of the death or how fast it happened or whatever other factors might be involved. I, as a policy, have a one follow-up, and then we'll decide from their kind of policy whether or not we need to do more. And I've reckoned and sort of validated my reason for this based on concerns I have about grief in general and how we view grief in society today. I can remember a family member of mine telling my grandmother one time that she needed to get over it. She'd dealt with a number of deaths in short order. And I was all of 9 years old at the time, and I remember wanting to hit my family member because I wasn't very happy with them. And in retrospect, I understand that I was right about not being happy with that logic, but not right to want to hit them or anything like that. Society has a tendency to portray grief as selfish. Modern psychology is saying things like, we grieve because that person can't spend the rest of our lives with us. I'm sorry, that is simply not biblical. And so I think that first visit is so important. That first visit, I always try to do it about a week after the funeral, because the thank yous have been written, the family has gone home, and especially if you're dealing like with a spouse or something like that, that spouse is now starting to feel the loneliness of it. That's a good time for the pastor, in essence, to strike. And the whole point is John 11, verse 35, the shortest verse in all the Bible, Jesus wept. It teaches us so much. It teaches us that grief is a holy act. If Jesus does it, it must be holy. Why is it a holy thing? Well, number one, because Jesus did it, but number two, because that person that we are mourning was a gift of God to us. And now that gift of God is gone. And we should feel that to some extent. Grief is a necessary thing. In my practice, I often provide a copy of Granger E. Westberg's classic on grief, Good Grief. Congregation usually buys copies, and I say this is for you, because they're going to get materials too from the funeral home that don't always reflect the gospel that we come from, that we come from, and that we maybe did the funeral in, and all of that kind of stuff. So Good Grief is a wonderful resource in that regard. Very important to get to the mourners early after the funeral. And then from there, let them help you decide how much more work you have to do with them.